Live and local from the 237 Roof Studios in Upper Lafayette. We are Acadiana Sports Station, 103.7 The Game, KLWB, Karen Crow, Lafayette. It's time to step your game up.
Boy, you wouldn't know how to write your name if it wasn't
stenciled on your locker.
It's Rep Game with RP3. Raymond Parts III.
One of God's own prototypes. A high-powered mutant of some kind never even considered for mass production. Too weird to live, too rare to die.
Want to interact? Call in at 337-706-0111.
We have it.
RP3 is taking the mic and bringing you to the center of the sports world on Rep Game with RP3 on 1037 The Game and 1037thegame.com.
You just got to keep living, man. L-I-V-I-N.
Solid. I'll tell you what I'm blathering about. I've got information, man.
Tillman has to back it out. Goins, open three, left wing, got it! The three falls for Kenny Goins! Michigan State, 68, Duke, 66 with 30 seconds to go.
Good morning, Acadiana. This is Raymond Parse III, your host for the Rap Game with RP3 right here on 103.7 The Game. We're broadcasting live, as always, from the 237 Roof Studios presented by Lafayette Roofing. If you want to give us a call today, you can. Arco Equipment Hotline is always open. And the man himself, Cody Schutz, is more than ready to field your phone calls at 337-706-0111. We have a jam-packed show today on this hump day edition of the Rap Game with RP3. We'll have Les East from CrescentCitySports.com breaking down some New Orleans Saints and some New Orleans Pelicans for us, as always. That'll be in the third hour. We'll also have UL head softball coach Jerry Glasgow. His team is on fire. They travel over to Lake Charles tonight for a midweek game against the Cowpokes. We'll talk to him also in the third hour. In the second hour, we'll have the voice of the LSU Tigers, our good friend, the one and only Chris Blair. And at 7:02, a baseball legend, an LSU legend, will be joining the program, the one and only, the College World Series hero himself, Warren Morris, will be joining us right here on the Rap Game with RP3. But first things first, it's time for our second preview of the Final Four. Yesterday, it was Texas Tech. We're going to stay on that side of the bracket with the other semifinal opponent, the one and only Michigan State Spartans. They will be taking on Texas Tech at 7:49 on Saturday in the Final Four there in Minneapolis. And Michigan State is the one team of the four that has a coach that's won a national championship. It has probably the most prestige of the four programs, since Texas Tech and Auburn are making their debuts at the Final Four. Virginia hasn't been at one since 1984. They also have a Hall of Famer coach in Tom Izzo. And look, this is a team that not only knocked out LSU in the Sweet 16, but then turned around and took out the top overall seed of the entire tournament, the Duke Blue Devils in Zion Williamson. Tom Izzo's repertoire is discipline, in-your-face intensity. They love playing defense. That's why I said on yesterday's game, don't be surprised if you see this game in the 60s. This is not going to be a high-scoring game between Sparty and the Red Raiders. Izzo has the experience. Okay, he's the only one, like I said before, with the blue blood. He's chasing his second title. Michigan State's always been one of those teams that's been very good in the NCAA tournament. I want to say Tom Izzo has guided Michigan State to 8 or 10 Elite Eight appearances, multiple Final Fours. He's chasing his second national championship. The first one came back in 1998. It's been that long. That would have been the Mateen Cleaves Michigan State team that won it all. It's been that long. It's been more than 20 years since Tom Izzo won a national championship. He also had the knock where he couldn't beat Coach K. Remember, he was like 1-10 before the Elite Eight on Sunday, where they were able to pull off the win. This is a very good team, and they're led by their point guard, who LSU had no answer for and Duke had no answer for. He's undersized, but he gets after it. He's tenacious, okay? It's going to be an interesting matchup how Texas Tech's point guards match up with Michigan State's. When you look at Michigan State, there's no one that really stands out. No one stands out. They don't have a projected lottery pick. Hell, they don't even have a projected first-round pick or possibly even a second-round pick on their roster. So somehow Michigan State still found a way, despite not having, quote-unquote, NBA-level talent, they still found a way to not only win the Big Ten regular season championship, then they went on to win the Big Ten tournament. Then they marched their way through the NCAA tournament and upset Duke along the way to punch their ticket to the Final Four. And that's a lot has to do with coaching. Tom Izzo is probably one of the best coaches in the country of getting more with less. He's one of those guys. You don't have to give him lottery picks. You don't have to give him four-star prospects coming out of high school. You don't have to give him those guys that had offers from big-time college programs when they were playing AAU ball in the eighth grade. No. He does this. His teams tend to be more veteran. This is Sparty's first trip back to the Final Four since 2015. It's also the eighth Final Four appearance under Tom Izzo. Now, the Spartans have opened as a 3.5-point favorite over the Red Raiders, which is to be expected. They have the more veteran coach. They're a little bit more of a veteran team. They understand what's at stake here. But this is going to be a close game. Okay. Michigan State's led by Cassius Winston. Once again, he's averaging nearly 19 points a game. He's their point guard. He's undersized, but he's tenacious. He's a fiery competitor. He sets the tone for Sparty. You know, this team under Tom Izzo, these teams are always known for their toughness. He encompasses that better than anyone else on the roster. They're going to be led by them. They got Kenny Goins. That's another name to kind of watch out for in Saturday's matchup. Kenny leads them in rebounding, about 9 rebounds a game. Okay? He's their best kind of post player. He does all the dirty work. Think of him, if you're an LSU fan, think of him as your Cavell Bigby Williams. Winston also leads them in assists, nearly 8 a game. So he leads them in scoring and leads them in assist. This is a guy who could be a double-double. Once again, Red Raiders are going to have their hands full trying to slow down Cassius Winston. LSU couldn't do it. Duke couldn't do it. Going to be a tall order for Texas Tech. The individual matchup, though, to look out for in Saturday's game between the Red Raiders and Sparty is this. Tariq Owens versus Xavier Tillman. Texas Tech is an undersized ball club. They don't have a lot of length and size, especially down low. But Owens has been a difference maker for the Red Raiders. Okay? A lot of the pub, deservingly so, has gone to Jarrett Culver. We talked about him on yesterday's show. He leads the Red Raiders in scoring, in rebounds, and assist. Okay? He's the engine that goes for that team. But Owens does do some dirty work. He only averages 8 points, but he also averages 8.5 rebounds and 2.5 blocks. Okay? And he stepped up big for the Red Raiders against Michigan and Gonzaga. Tillman, on the other hand, for Michigan State, was even better. Averaging nearly 16 points, 9 rebounds, and 2 blocks last weekend. That's going to be kind of a interesting matchup. Once again, Michigan State's going to have the size advantage. But if Owens can win that one-on-one matchup with Tillman, that could be huge for the Red Raiders. But Winston, though, is special. This is a guy who could possibly, if Michigan State wins the whole thing, you're going to have to look at Winston as the tournament MVP. And you got him running the point, and then you got Michigan State's big man rotation with Tillman, with Aaron Henry, with Kenny Goins, okay, and others. So that's going to be the interesting thing. Now, look, even though Michigan State may have the more experience as the program in the Final Four on that stage, on the biggest stage in college basketball, they haven't been the best in the Final Four. Under Tom Izzo, as great as he's been, they're 2-5 in the Final Four. You know, and we've established that the Texas Tech Red Raiders, they're no slouches, right? They beat Gonzaga, they beat Michigan. So this is a team that knows how to take down the big dogs. They have a great, young, dynamic coach. So it won't be easy for Sparty. But for me, if Winston can dominate the game like he did against LSU, like he did against Duke, like he's done all season. Now, mind you, here's the other thing about Sparty. They lost what was supposed to be their starting point guard at the beginning of the season. And then they lost the backup point guard during the season. So they lost the two guys that are supposed to be running Tom Izzo's offense on the floor. They were able to overcome that. They've been banged up as the season has progressed, and they've lost guys. And yet, somehow, Tom Izzo just rotates guys in, and other guys step up in a big way. That's why I think Sparty has the advantage here, because even though the Red Raiders have done that as well, they had to replace four of their leading scorers from last year's ball club that reached the Elite Eight and lost to Villanova. And they have a projected lottery pick. Michigan State's gone through a little bit more adversity during the season, losing star players. And Michigan State doesn't have lottery picks, right? They don't have those guys. So if a guy is on the roster and Tom Izzo has them slated, he's going to be fundamentally key to what they do on the floor. And having to adjust that because they don't have a wealth of talent there at Michigan State, to be able to overcome that like they have has been beyond impressive. So I think that little bit of adversity, and I think the deciding factor that's going to come down into Saturday's semifinal matchup is going to be Cassius Winston. If Cassius Winston goes off like he has all tournament long, and like he did in the Big Ten tournament, and like he did during the regular season, no one's going to be able to beat Sparty. Not the Red Raiders. And not whoever comes out of the other side of the bracket. So I would have to give Michigan State the slight advantage. We will give our predictions for the Final Four on Friday's show after we give our fourth and final preview of the Final Four teams. Texas Tech was yesterday. Michigan State was today. Tomorrow will be Virginia, the Cavaliers. And then we will wrap up the week on Friday with the team that I hate to talk about more than any other, the Auburn Tigers. It will be painful for me, Cody, on Friday. Just letting you know. You may have to help your boy out somehow. Just saying. We're going to keep it rolling here on the Wrap Game with RP3. Coming up next, Cajuns baseball. Not only do they get a big midweek win last night at the Teague, Tony Robichaux also reached a milestone. We'll talk more about that right here on the Wrap Game with RP3 on 103.7 The Game. Welcome back to the Wrap Game with RP3. I am your host, Raymond Parse III, on this hump day edition of the show on 103.7 The Game. Broadcasting live from the 237 Roof Studios, presented by Lafayette Roofing. You can give us a call on the ARCO Equipment Hotline if you'd like. 337-706-0111. We led off the show talking about the Final Four, giving a little insight on what Sparty brings to the table. Well, now it's time to head out to the Diamond. It was a good night here in Acadiana, Cody, as the Rajon Cajuns got that midweek win, a much-needed midweek win, I might add. They've had some struggles on the weekend series. They've suffered multiple weekends of dropping series in conference. So they avoided the sweep on Sunday. And then they came back yesterday at the Teague, needing a much-needed victory, and they got one, brother. 8-2 over the Southeastern Mighty Lions. They will once again play Southeastern in a makeup game at Hammond tonight. So it's a back-to-back playing the same team. That's a game scheduled earlier in the season that got washed out because of weather. LSU's doing the same thing where they're having to play South Alabama tonight. That's a makeup game as well. But for the Cajuns, 8-2 victory. Terrific performance, pitching and hitting for the Raging Cajuns. Okay? Sophomore Logan Savoy was on the bump. Louisiana gets to 14-16 overall. Now at 4-5, they still 4-5 in conference play. They out-hit the Lions 9-3, while Savoy and Connor Cook struck out 8 Lions and allowed just 2 earned runs in the victory. Savoy is making his first career start. He went 6 2/3 innings, gave up only 2 hits and the 2 runs for a career-best 7 strikeouts. Cook finished things off in the final 2 1/3, with the only blemish being a single that he gave up in the 9th inning. Sophomore Hayden Cantrell, who I feel like we talk about a lot on this show, and rightfully so, the former Turlings Catholic star, has been tearing it up for the Raging Cajuns this year. He went 2-for-5 last night with a home run and 3 RBIs. That cat is small, Cody. That's like you out there, bro. Okay? Now, Hayden is bulked up a little bit, but he's a tiny dude. He's a middle infielder. And he's out there blasting home runs at the Teague. It's so impressive to watch him get out there. He's always been sensational with the glove. He also did some pitching back in high school, by the way, as well for the Rebels. And I've always was impressed by him and his performance on the field in high school. I was waiting for him to kind of break through at the collegiate level. And this year, he is just having a monstrous year. Like, he's performing at a first-team all-Sun Belt kind of level. He's not a large man by any stretch, but he brings a big bat to the table. Went 2-for-5 last night with a home run and 3 ribbies. Hunter Castles, he added a 2-for-4 effort as well with a homer of his own and 2 RBIs. And then Todd Lott, he also had a multi-hit game going 2-for-3. He'd extended his personal hitting streak to 12 games for this year. Tremendous performance by the Raging Cajuns. They need another performance like that. Tonight, you want to win these back-to-backs. You want to get even closer to being .500 entering this weekend's home series versus Ark State. They need to build this momentum. They avoid the sweep over the weekend at Troy, taking the rubber match on Sunday. Then they take care of Southeastern last night. If they can beat Southeastern again, that's 3 games in a row heading into that weekend series. And the way the bats are coming together and you're getting some good pitching performances as well, maybe you can take 2 or 3 because they need that. They've dropped the series at Troy. They dropped the series at App State. They won at Little Rock, but before that, they lost a series against Loyola Marymount. They got swept by Sam Houston. They lost the series to Texas. You know, they've only won 2 weekend series, and we're in April. That was against Maryland out of the Big Ten to start the month of March, and then they took that series at Little Rock. Every other series they've lost. So this midweek games could be a catalyst for the Raging Cajuns to get things going in the right direction. Once again, we've talked about it here on the program before. This is a talented team. Todd Lott is a good baseball player. Hayden Cantrell is a damn good baseball player. Okay, Hanson Monica is a good they have good baseball players on that team. They just have not been able to play consistent baseball. They have struggled this season. When the bats are off, the pitching's great. When the pitching's not great, the bats are on. They have not been able to put it all together on a consistent basis over a span of like 4, 5, 6, 7 games. And if they want to turn a corner, if they want to compete and try to win the Sun Belt Championship regular season and then build that momentum into a postseason run against the likes of Coastal Carolina, who's now in their conference, then they have to get things going. You have to win weekend series. You're going to be hard-pressed to find a ball club that loses weekend series that is going to compete for a conference championship. Now, yeah, they could get hot at the right time. Absolutely. Absolutely they could. But it'd be a lot better for them if they could get hot right now, win this game tonight at Southeastern there in Hammond, build that momentum against Arkansas State over the weekend, take that series win, get above 500 overall on the season, improve your record in conference play, get above 500 in Sun Belt play as well, and then get things rolling. Because then after that, you got Louisiana Tech coming to town next week. You got McNeese coming to town, two midweek games that you should be able to win if you play to your potential. And then back at home at the Teague versus South Alabama. That's all before the Wally Pontiff Classic. But the big story also last night, that 8-2 win also did something else. The victory was historic for Tony Robichaud. The longtime head baseball coach for the Raging Cajuns picked up career win number 900 as the head coach of the Raging Cajuns. He has far more victories than that because of his 8 years as the head baseball coach over in Lake Charles at McNeese State. But last night was the 900th win for Tony Robichaud as head coach of the UL baseball team. Tony entered the season as the 8th winningest active head coach in Division I baseball, and now, with last night's victory, has 1,163 wins in his career. The man has nearly won 1,200 ball games as the skipper. So not only congrats to the Raging Cajuns for getting a much-needed midweek victory, but also congrats to Tony Robichaud for picking up win number 900. Congratulations to him. When we come back here on the Wrap Game with RP3, we're going to talk LSU baseball. They got a midweek victory as well against the Grambling State Tigers. Right here on 103.7 The Game.
That's an off-speed pitch hit deep to right field. Wheeler looks like he's having trouble locating it, and this ball is in the right field stands. You can pucker up and kiss that baby goodbye. Josh Smith had a towering fly ball. Wheeler looked confused from the get-go. I don't think he ever located it until the end, and then it was out of his reach.
That's the Louisiana Sports Hall of Famer, Lynn Rollins, on the call there from LSU's baseball last night.
Friend of the station.
Friend of the station. 9-0 over Grambling State. That was pretty funny, Cody. You were watching that game. Share a little bit. You were watching.
Not even about the whole game. Just exactly.
Just the home run.
Just that specific play. As a baseball fan, regardless, you can't help but chuckle a little bit how it happens. You feel bad for the outfielder because there's nothing he can do about it. But Josh Smith hits that ball approximately 69 miles in the air. No one can see it. Lynn Rollins has no idea. You can listen back to that call. He has no idea where the ball is. He's watching the outfielder. The camera guy has no idea where the ball is. He's got the camera on the outfielder. The outfielder is doing the arms out, glove, palms to the sky. I have no idea. Someone help me.
Coach, I can't help you, coach.
He's looking around. He's trying to find the ball. The camera, he's running. And then finally, the outfielder's still looking for the ball in the air. The camera cuts back to Josh Smith, and he is in his slow home run trot hitting third base. Like, he is at third base before the outfielder realizes, oh, that's in the bleachers. Damn, okay. Like, it was one of those, I mean, a moonshot, if you will. It rained Skittles after he hit that home run.
It rained Skittles. Yeah, so a nice, convincing victory.
They needed one like this. Not that it does any good for your team. Not that it makes your team any better. But they needed
a whooping.
Since it's WrestleMania week, a WrestleMania momentum kind of win.
Right. They just need to go out there and just mow someone down and flex their muscles and be LSU. Right? You know what I'm saying? Like, they just needed that.
Shutout feels good, too.
It does.
That means your pitching is still where it's been.
Only the second shutout of the year, believe it or not.
Shutouts are rare in college.
Yes,
baseball.
They are. Clay Moffitt pitched well last night for the Tigers, who improved to 20-9 overall. LSU will return to action tonight as they play that makeup game with South Alabama. You can listen to that game live right here on 103.7 The Game. The good brother Ben Love will be broadcasting live from 4 to 6. No pregame show tonight. Ben Love will just broadcast from 4 to 6, bumper to bumper sports, and we'll go right into first pitch there at like 6:02 against South Alabama. Moffitt, the senior righty, he worked 5 scoreless innings to earn the win. He allowed only 2 hits and recorded a career-best 5 strikeouts. I'm liking what I'm seeing out of Moffitt. If you could have him kind of lock down being the midweek guy, Cody, that can kind of free up and help with the soreness and the use of all those other arms. If Moffitt can be your midweek guy, maybe Hilliard can be sent to the weekend. Like, I just
you just jinxed him. LSU is, it seems like there have been at minimum a handful of guys in the past 2 to 3 seasons that have been like, oh man, here's the kid, he's going to lock down that midweek. Nope, out for 6 months. Oh, here's that kid, he's going to lock down that midweek, and he sucks. Like, here's that kid, he's going to lock down, he's so good, and the other guys suck that he has to move to the weekend. Whether it's one reason or another, LSU, they seem to never have that guy in the midweek.
Last couple years, you're right. The arms have been a weird thing. We've talked about this on the show. But the young man did have a heck of a game, like I said, only allowed 2 hits and recorded a career-best 5 strikeouts. This is what Paul Maneri had to say afterwards. From a pitching standpoint, it couldn't have gone any better than it did tonight. You've got to give a lot of credit to Clay Moffitt for his outing. We played good defense behind all of our pitchers. To get a shutout with Clay, Rye, and Will was fantastic. Grambling pitcher Kerry Boykins Jr., he suffered the loss. His ERA now is 9. 9. That's like 3 field goals.
Yeah, I mean, that's
a touchdown, extra point, and a safety.
That's giving up a run every inning you were on the mound.
But he's still 3-1 overall in the year, but his ERA is now 9.
You know what that tells me? The swack is bad.
Oh, that tells me yes. Yes, he only pitched 3 innings and allowed 7 hits and 8 runs. Oh,
yikes.
Antoine Duplantis, Lafayette High's own. He set the tone, and he's great about this, and he's such a low-key cat. Like, even back when I covered him in high school and interviewed him back then, he's just a low-key kind of guy. You know what I'm saying? Like, he's not demonstrative or anything like that, not braggadocious.
Very unassuming. You wouldn't look at him and think much.
If you were at Rouse's and you went down the aisle and you passed Antoine Duplantis, you wouldn't think that he's going to...
The best player on the LSU baseball team.
You just wouldn't. you just wouldn't. He's just unassuming, and he's kind of got a slender build. But he sets the tone for that team, and he singled to right to start the game for LSU. Then he moved to second on a throwing error and then advanced to third on a base hit by Smith. And then when Reed grounded out to first base, Duplantis was able to score.
The game got off to a weird start.
It was a weird start, but think about that. That's just pure kind of like he just gets a little single to right field. That's it.
Second baseman dove for it, couldn't get there.
He gets to second on the throwing error.
They tried to pick him off at first base, take second.
And then he advances to third on a base hit by Smith. And then scores on a ground out. That's what you get from Antoine. He has the 2 home run game the other day. You do get that display of power from time to time, but Duplantis is going to find a way to put himself in scoring position.
Yeah.
Okay.
That power, those power number, anything like that, that's all gravy. That's the cherry on top, the icing on the cake. Other analogies. As God bless you, Raymond.
Thank you. Yes, Duplantis always finds a way to do it. And you're right, the power is just gravy. I just like the way that this team is starting to play. Once again, C.J. Willis got in there. But then it was Smith, right? Two outs in the third. He gets to the plate and just has what you said. He hit it so high that Skittles came down.
Yeah, yeah. It was a moonshot. It was it rained Skittles after approximately 69 miles in the air.
Approximately.
That's not a fact.
Not a fact, he says. So terrific performance by LSU. And you want them to mow down the competition like this, right?
It gets a little tougher tonight.
South Alabama's a better team. Historically a better team.
And a better conference.
Better conference. And this is going to be comparable or a little bit better than playing the likes of McNeese and Nichols and Northwestern State, who they've struggled with, right? For whatever reason this year, LSU struggled with the Southland teams in particular, which is weird. Southeastern, they needed a couple runs to beat. Nichols, they had their hands full with them. They pulled out the win. They lose to Northwestern State. They lost to McNeese. So
there's a walk-off in there as well against another in-state school. I forget who, I believe, but there's a walk-off on a midweek game.
Right. So they'll need to reset. It's good to get that momentum and crush Grambling. Show them no mercy.
Not in this dojo.
Not in this dojo. But then they got a good South Alabama team. And once again, this is a time for South Alabama to make a statement as well, right? You know, Grambling may be undermanned, so to speak, overwhelmed by playing LSU. South Al's a little bit different. They play in the Sun Belt. They're a good program, traditionally speaking. You're going to get a very good – I would expect a closer game. If LSU can come out tonight and mow down South Al, woo, then they may have really found their mojo. And then after winning that series at Mississippi State, crushing Grambling, if they can go out and crush South Al, hell, they don't need to crush South Al. As long as they go out and beat South Al, that's all they got to do. Get the win and move it forward for the weekend as Texas A&M comes to town, right? That's all you want to do because those SEC series are so key, especially with the depth of talent in the SEC this year. We talked about it yesterday on the show, Cody. All these teams that are ranked in the top 25, Texas A&M, Mississippi State, Georgia, Vanderbilt, LSU, I know I'm missing a few.
Oh, I happen to be looking at it right now. SEC schools in the top 25. Let me go back to get out of collegiate baseball because they do a top 30. But according to D1, you've got Georgia at 4, Vandy at 5, Mississippi State at 8, A&M is 9, LSU 13, Arkansas 14, Auburn 15, Ole Miss 18, Florida 21.
Jesus.
I'm just reading the list. Yeah. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 schools in the top 25. There are 14 in the conference total.
So they've already played two of those. They've already played Georgia and Mississippi
and
State.
And the Dawgs. Well, both Dawgs.
They host A&M this weekend.
Correct.
Then
Vandy's not on the schedule.
Vandy's not on the schedule. But after the Wally Pontiff Classic versus UL on April 16th, then the next series at home will be against Florida, who you just mentioned is ranked in the top 25.
Yep.
Then they're at home in May versus Ole Miss, who's in the top 25, yes?
Correct.
Arkansas is at Arkansas.
They're top 15.
Did you say Auburn, too?
Auburn is number 15.
Auburn's going to be at home. That's the last series before the SEC tournament.
It ain't getting no easier.
Oh, no, it's not. So, yeah. So,
hey, if Kofi Kingston and the New Day can run that gauntlet and get him a title match at WrestleMania, then LSU baseball can run this gauntlet and win the SEC as well.
I'm just going to applaud
Kofi Mania, baby.
For folding in the WrestleMania talk. It is WrestleMania week, obviously. Sunday is WrestleMania.
Correct.
With a historic three-way match for...
Yeah, triple threat. First time the women have ever headlined
WrestleMania. Yes. I applaud you, my friend, for not only bringing the knowledge on who's ranked in the SEC in the national polls, but for seamlessly transitioning and getting that WrestleMania in there. You've been working on behind the scenes. I love it.
SmackDown was last night. SmackDown is where the Kofi Kingston storyline lives. So last night was the SmackDown ended. The go-home look from Raw, I told you, was Kurt Angle in the ankle lock on Baron Corbin, him tapping out. Fade to black. Yeah. Last night, the fade to black was Kofi Kingston tearing Daniel Bryan down one side, up, yeah, because Dan Bryan, B-plus player, this, blah, blah, blah. Kofi Kingston basically, long story short, said, I've been here 11 years. This is my first singles opportunity at the WWE Championship. You were WWE Champion, Daniel Bryan, after only being here 2 years. I don't want to hear you talk about things you've been through. You don't know what I've been through. He signs the contract, pen to paper, slams it into Michael Cole's chest, and just stares at Daniel Bryan as they fade to black. So hype. So incredibly hype.
I can tell. You're ready to, like, put on the singlet right now and do a flying elbow off the top turnbuckle
here
in the studio.
I think maybe I could pull off a Spanish fly. I'm thinking that might be possible right now. If you don't know what it is, Google it.
When we come back, we will wrap up the first hour of the Rap Game with RP3. The NFL released their new draft night hats by New Era. Some of them are on fire. Some of them are hot garbage. We will discuss them right here on the show on 103.7 The Game after this. Welcome back to the Rap Game with RP3. I am your host, Raymond Parsa III, here on 103.7 The Game, broadcasting live from the 237 Roof Studios, presented by Lafayette Roofing. Yesterday, the official 2019 NFL Draft Night hats by New Era were released. Now, I thought some of them were absolutely hot fire. Others were, in fact, hot garbage. Or as...
basura, basura.
Or as Andrew Clay told me yesterday in a little back and forth on the Twitter, they look like the cheap knockoffs I can buy at the bodega.
Look, before we'll talk some specifics about certain hats on this list, I imagine, but they are better than these. Weren't the draft night hats, and this has been a good handful of years ago. But the sideline hats that you see Drew Brees always throws on the ball cap when he's on the sideline, right?
Yeah.
The official ball caps, however many years ago was. Do you remember when they had the rubber bill?
Oh,
you remember that? Dude. Yeah, my dad tried to buy me one of those, and I was like, "I love you, pops, but I don't want this."
No doubt.
So these are better than that. We'll say that much.
Yes. So the thing behind it this year, what New Era tried to do is they tried to make them city and state centric. So
by the flags in the market of each NFL's franchise.
Correct.
So the market.
Right. So they tried to incorporate whether it was the state flag or the city flag into the designs.
Now that I see that, though, the Saints hat makes a little bit more sense.
It's still one of the worst, though.
Think about it, though. It's got the three fleur-de-lis on the front. If this is for the market of the team, Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama.
That's true.
I don't know if that's what they were going for or not, but reading their explanation as to why the designs are the way they are, maybe. That's my initial thought. Because if you haven't seen it, the Saints hat is solid black. It looks great, but it has... Instead of just the single fleur-de-lis right in the middle of the hat like you normally see, it has that one, and then it's accented by two smaller fleur-de-lis on either side.
That's
I don't know
correct.
Why I acted that out with my hands.
31 of the teams were released. The one team that was not released were the Jets.
I didn't even notice
that. The Jets are releasing a new uniform, and apparently they want to save the hat for that. So that's why we don't have the Jets hat on there. There's only 31 instead of 32 teams. So, USA Today decided to rank the New Era collection of NFL draft night hats for the second straight year. And, Saints fans, you're going to like this. Coming in last place in their rankings is the Carolina Panthers. And this is their description. This is what I love. Okay, so the Panthers hat, and we will tweet out a link So everyone can go check out all 31 hats by New Era, the new NFL draft, draft night hats. We'll tweet that out through the 1037 The Game Twitter account. But the Panthers have their color scheme, and they got the big Panther on one side, but then they got, like, North Carolina, and then they got a palmetto tree and a crescent moon.
That's the South Carolina flag. The South Carolina state flag is completely blank, and that symbol you see, that's the only thing on it. It's right there in the middle.
But Charlotte's in North Carolina.
But it's the market of the team.
See,
you keep hinging on the state of the team or the city. The quote was the market of the team.
I got you. There's a lot going on.
There is a whole lot going on. And I told you during the break, I just have a personal preference towards the state flag of South Carolina. I've spent a lot of time there. My brother lived there. So I actually like the palmetto and crescent moon. Still hate the Panthers. So, you know, that's fine. But
29th, the Falcons.
Yeah, that one is... If it was any other team, this would be really cool. I like it, but it's the Falcons. So
Cowboys hat's kind of boring, which is a surprise. The Texans, I like the
color scheme. See the Cowboy hat. I see what they did, though. It is the state flag, just with gray instead of red. I see what they did.
Correct, yes. Yeah. I like the Chiefs hat.
I don't get it. I like it, but I don't get it. Like, it's got, I don't know what the it's like, it looks like a fountain almost.
One,
you know?
One of my favorite, two of my favorites, though, are the Steelers hat. They got that checkerboard, which looks really
clean. It's like a racing stripe. It's got the checkerboard like a finish line, and then the racing stripe down the center of the hat.
I hate to say it, Saints fans, the Rams hat looks really cool too. It's nice and clean. It's just white and the royal blue.
It's got the jagged edge to kind of throw back to the old jerseys.
I like that. The Bengals hat looks like something my four-year-old daughter would make.
Yeah.
The Eagles have the city's seal on the brim, almost like tattooed on there. That's kind of interesting.
It says Delphia Manetto.
Have a lot going on the brim of the hat. Mm-hmm. The most boring one, which actually looks pretty clean, is the Bears. It's just the Bear logo, and that's it.
Yeah,
There's nothing else on the
they
hat.
I didn't think about that at all. Like,
well, I don't know if like the teams play a role in that.
No, Mike Ditka showed up and just started kicking doors down.
Mike Singletary, who's now unemployed, just went there and said, "What are you doing?" He just stared at him with his eyes. One of my favorites though is the Tennessee Titans. I like that. I like the look. I'm always a big fan of that kind of color blue. And I have to give it up to Tampa Bay. The hat is clean. I hate to say it. The hat is clean. The Dolphins got some palm trees on theirs. The Raiders are all bold. You know, they talk about Raider Nation, so they got the Raiders logo, and they got a black and white American flag behind them.
The Dolphins might be my favorite.
The Chargers, they got that powder blue color coming in on the back. Oh, I like that. I like that a lot. 12, man, give it up to Seattle. They know what their market is.
Oh, yeah.
They got the big 12 on the front.
Texas A&M pays them for that.
Yes, they do.
Or do they pay Texas A&M? It goes one way or the other.
So the Saints one is a little underwhelming, but opinion has been mixed, to say the least. Some people say there's hot fire. Some people say it's hot garbage. Some people say it's both. You decide. Go check it out. We'll post it on our Twitter account.
Yep.
On the 1037 The Game account. First hour's in the books. When we come back, we're going to talk to the legend himself, College World Series hero Warren Morris, right here on the Rap Game with RP3. On 1037 The Game.
Live and local from the 237 Roof Studios in Upper Lafayette. We are Acadiana Sports Station. 1037 The Game. KLWB, Karen Crow, Lafayette. It's time to step your game up.
Boy, you wouldn't know how to write your name if it wasn't set for the clock.
It's Rap Game with RP3. Raymond Parts III.
One of God's own prototypes. High-powered mutant of some kind never even considered for mass production. Too weird to live, too rare to die.
Want to interact? Call in at 337-706-0111.
We have it. Yeah, we have it.
RP3 is taking the mic and bringing you to the center of the sports world on Rap Game with RP3 on 1037 The Game and 1037thegame.com.
He's got to keep living, man. L-I-V-I-N.
Solid. I'll tell you what I'm blathering about. I've got information, man.
The stretch by Mars in the pitch. Swung on and hit the right field. That's way back there. Way back there. Hold on!
Welcome to the second hour of the Rap Game with RP3. I am your host, Raymond Parch III, here on 103.7 The Game. We're broadcasting live from the 237 Roof Studios, presented by Lafayette Roofing. As you heard on that famous clip, it was two outs in the ninth inning that our next guest hit a walk-off home run that won the 1996 College World Series for the LSU Fighting Tigers. The Alexandria native second baseman would go on to play in the big leagues for nearly five seasons. He was also a member of the men's baseball team for the United States Olympics team that took bronze at the 1996 games in Atlanta. It's the legendary LSU baseball player himself, Warren Morse. Warren, welcome to the show. Good morning to you, brother. How are you?
Hey, good morning, Raymond. Good to be on. Thanks for having me.
I appreciate you making some time for us, brother. It's been more than 20-some-odd years now, man, and people still talk about that moment, still talk about that day where you hit that game-winning home run. What is that like to deal with, I guess, for people still to want to talk about it and still bring it up? I mean, is it still flattering that all this time has passed and you haven't played baseball in nearly a generation and yet people still remember you and remember that moment?
Oh, yeah, it's very flattering. I really love it. I don't get tired of talking about it. You know, it's a good thing. Unfortunately, there's people that played this great game and they did something, let a ball roll through their legs or something at a bad time, and that's what people remember them for. So if people remember me for that home run and winning that championship, I think that's great. You know, I get to talk to them, and they get to tell me the story. They remember where they were, whose wedding reception, or what exit on the interstate they were listening to it. And it's just neat that moment in time sticks out, and they remember, and they love telling me about it. So I love hearing about it.
It's so personal for them, right, Warren? I mean, like you just said, they mentioned they remember exactly where they were, what they were doing, how it impacted their life. And I guess the story for you, it still remains enjoyable because it's a different reaction, and it brought them so much joy that the story's always different when they tell it to you, and it's almost part of their life.
Yeah, and I mean, that's just it. That's what's so great, because it's something that they remember for a lot of joy. You know, I've had people share stories and say, you know, they had a loved one in the hospital and they were watching it. And, you know, that might have been one of the last great memories that they had with that loved one. You know, just fun things, too. It seems like a lot of the people that got excited and jumped up either hit their hand or their head on a ceiling fan. That's like 80% of the story. So just fun. You know, it's unreal that 23 years later, people still come up and tell me about it. I mean, I bet it's not every day, but I bet a week doesn't go by that somebody doesn't bring that up and want to tell me something about when they were watching that game.
Walk me through, if you don't mind, kind of appease me a little bit here, Warren. You go through that, and I know that they had the SEC Network did the little documentary about that game and that moment and everything like that. But walk us through it. You know, you weren't known as a power guy, and yet you step into the box and you were able to blast the game-winning home run. What was your thought process when you got into the box? Were you thinking home run, or were you just thinking trying to make contact?
No, not thinking home run at all. And, you know, it's kind of a long story, but I was injured most of that season and just kind of coming back. And, you know, even after having wrist surgery, you know, Coach Bertman basically said, you know, we just want you in there, do what you can do, slap at the ball, bunt when you need to. So, you know, really didn't feel like I could take a full swing and 100% until just before that championship game. And, you know, just really just trying to get in the box and be aggressive, you know, not think about the enormity of the moment, to really just in my mind, just, you know, take it one pitch at a time and hopefully get a line drive, score Brad Wilson from third base. And I was batting ninth that day. So if I get on base and score him, it's tied up. And then the top of the lineup's coming on. So that was kind of my thought process. And I mean, even as the ball came off the bat, I'm running hard thinking maybe I got a chance for a double. And, that ball crept over the fence, and out of the corner of my eye, I see our first base coach, Daniel Tomlin, jump higher than I thought he could. That's when it first registered, that ball, that's a home run. And, you know, from there, kind of just floating around the bases and get to home plate and your teammates mob you and be on the bottom of that pile. I mean, just a special, I guess, I mean, who scripted? That's the last swing of the bat I had at LSU. So, I mean, something, if I would have written a fairy tale ending, I couldn't have written something that good.
We're talking to LSU baseball legend Warren Morris. Warren, are you surprised in all the years since then that is become the most famous and well-known moment in College World Series history?
Oh, definitely surprised. I mean, I can still remember the next day as we went to the Omaha airport, you know, just seeing the front page of the newspaper and my picture on there and talking about LSU wins and just thinking, wow, that's unbelievable. I'm on the front page of the newspaper. And never at that point thought that this would carry on like it has, or SEC Network would want to do a special on it. But I think it's great. You know, that special, they did a good job on it, and it helps tell the story for a younger generation, because sometimes I get a chance to speak with, you know, high school kids, and I have to remind myself they weren't even born whenever I hit that ball, but they're able to watch that or watch YouTube and see the moment and kind of get a feel for what happened. And, you know, I enjoy being able to share what was going on in my mind. So, you know, it's fun. I never knew it would live on this long in LSU fans' minds, but it's kind of cool whenever I run into some sports fans out there that live in other parts of the country, and they say, oh, I remember that moment. So it's truly carried on, and it's just great for me that I get to meet all these people that, you know, without that home run, and they would never have a reason to come up and say hi.
Warren, let's talk a little bit about this year's team, and I want to get your perspective on it as a former player. We had Jeff Palermo and Chris Blair both on in recent weeks talking about that Mississippi State series, and talking about how it's always been one kind of – it's got a little edge to it back in the day, because in the 80s when Skip was building up the program at LSU, they were doing the same thing at Mississippi State, and they really put the SEC baseball on the map during the 80s into the early 90s. As a player that was part of that rivalry, can you give us a little insight on just how heated that Mississippi State versus LSU baseball rivalry really is?
Yeah, I mean, it's just two great powerhouses, two great programs that have a great history, you know, and I think a lot of it you have to attribute to the fans. You know, the fans in Baton Rouge are like no other. But if you got to pick somebody that's pretty close, you go to Starkville, and they love their baseball. They're passionate. They make it into a festival. You know, there's cooking going on. It's just a fun time. So when they come to Alex Box Stadium, it's going to be, you know, just a knockdown drag out. You never know who's going to win. It comes down to the end. And then same thing when we go to Starkville. And, you know, I honestly was looking for close games, and, you know, that first game was. But then for us, the way that we really just took it to them, the second game and the third game, I mean, it just shows what this team is capable of. You know, everybody's going to go through their ups and downs in the season, and, you know, they had some games. I know they didn't play as well as they would have liked to, but there's a lot of season left, and I really think this team, they've got something special, so I hope they keep it going.
Let's talk a little bit about this year's team. You know, they started off with big expectations. Paul Menary said, you know, we're going to talk about Omaha right here on Media Day, and then we're going to shut it down. And they started off the season strong. They've had a couple of lulls there. With the starting pitching trying to come into form, and also the lineup, you know, the hitting kind of went down a little bit for a few weeks. As a guy that's played this game at such a high level, a national champion yourself, Warren, how do you as a player kind of go through that? Because there's so many ups and downs. The season is so long. You're playing so many games. How do you guys kind of deal with that, to deal with the ups and downs of, hey, you know what, we just dropped a series that we probably should have won, or we dropped a midweek game to an in-state school that we should have routed by 10. What do you do as a player in those kind of moments throughout the season?
Well, I mean, I think it all has to do with, you know, your mindset. And Coach Burtman was great about reminding us that, you know, this season, it is not a sprint by any means. It's a marathon. So you kind of, you can't get too up on the highs. You can't get too down on the lows. Yeah, I mean, we lost in-state games. We lost to the team right here across the river from me in Alexandria while I was there, Louisiana College. Good program, but that's an NAIA team. You know, they probably shouldn't on paper match up and even stay close, but they beat us that night. But, you know, we still ended up in Omaha, so it's tough. I understand we live in a football-loving state, and, you know, in football, every game is an end-all, be-all. But in baseball, you want to win every game, but nobody's ever going to win them all. So I think these guys do a good job. They have some veterans on there that realize, you know, if we didn't win game one, we still win the next two. We win the series. So I think just that perspective of realizing it is, like you said, a long season, and you got to just take it as it is. Every game is a new game, but don't let it linger. Don't let the because that's when you get in trouble, is when you let one loss turn into three or four, and then it's kind of hard to dig out of that hole.
Warren, I want to get your thoughts on midweek games. A lot of people in my line of work kind of rail against them. They say they don't matter. I've always taken the opposite approach to that. I think they do matter to the guys, because if they didn't, you know, I've watched LSU this year get really excited about winning a midweek game and then have a players-only meeting after losing a midweek game. I know we like to think that midweek games are irrelevant and it only matters the weekend series. From a player's perspective, you guys do care, or do you not care about the midweek games?
No, I mean, I think you definitely care. And I think it's a great opportunity to showcase baseball around the state. You know, like it or not, you know, LSU brings a big crowd with them. So whenever LSU comes to play Northwestern and Natchitoches, or comes to Southeastern and Hammond, it's going to be a packed house. And, you know, I doubt that would happen if it was just any other ordinary midweek game. So that sense, it puts a little pressure on LSU. I think that helps them to focus, because, you know, the ultimate goal for any of these teams is what you do in the postseason. So the more you can kind of be battle-tested in tough environments and, you know, be able to step up when needed, I think that helps. Also, I think, you know, there's a pride factor. You know, you never want to lose to one of these in-state schools where maybe there's a buddy or two on there that you played in high school or against. So, I mean, I think there's a lot of reasons. In-state games are great. You know, a lot of times it's a little – it makes it's almost you're up against a little bit of a disadvantage, I guess, in the pitching realm sometimes, because a lot of times those in-state guys, their number one guy is good enough probably play for LSU. And they're pitching him, and maybe we're not pitching one of our weekend guys. So, but that doesn't matter. You still got to find a way to win. And I'm with you. I think they're good. I enjoy having them, and I like the way Coach Maneri and the staff kind of gets a different variety of midweek games and people that they play.
Warren, when was the last time that you were able to catch a game live there at Alex Box?
I need to get down this season. I haven't been this year. I got to see three or four last year. I did see the team play last month against Northwestern, about an hour away from me. But no, I love coming to Alex Box. Just to be, it's hard for me to believe there's a better college baseball venue. You know, just from my pro ball playing days, it's every bit as great as, you know, almost big league quality, other than the size of it. But, I mean, it's perfect for college baseball. Parking's not an issue, easy to get in and out, and you see a great game, and it's great atmosphere. So, no, I'm looking forward to getting down and catching some games. I love watching the Tigers, and, you know, Coach Maneri's doing a great job. You know, they still have the heart of the SEC season, and I think he's got his guys really starting to believe. And, you know, I don't think he's reaching too much when he was talking Omaha. So, of course, there's a lot that's left to do, and you got to get hot at the right time, but I think these guys can do it.
Warren, I appreciate you taking some time out of your day talking to us, brother. It was great catching up, and enjoy the rest of your week, and I hope you get to get back down to Alex Box and catch a couple of games this season. We'll talk to you soon.
All right. Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me, Raymond.
Warren Morse, LSU baseball legend. College World Series hero, joining us here on the Wrap Game with RP3. When we come back here, we're going to talk about the Alliance of American Football. It's no more. It has ceased to exist. It was a great 8 weeks, Cody Schutz.
At least they made it a whole season. Oh, no. No. No, wait.
Time to hit the clearance rack on the online store. Give me some of that discounted gear.
You want some discounted Memphis Express gear? Oh, God. Johnny Manziel kills everything.
By the way, that may or not be your Christmas present for me this year. His Memphis Express gear.
I want that Metty B jersey.
You and world-famous Clint D, and especially Ben Love, who was not a big fan of the Alliance. I'll make sure to get him.
Did they ever come out with a T-shirt that says The Met Show?
They should.
They should have.
We're going to look. We're going to look it up. We'll talk more about the Alliance folding when we get back here on the Rap Game with RP3, right here on 103.7 The Game.
So, we're all disappointed, but on the other side, we got to be the champs, right? We're 7-1, and the next teams are 5-3. So, some of us didn't get into the Alliance to try to advance our careers. But the players, I'm more disappointed for all the players that believe this is, you know, my chance to show people and this, that, and the other that I can play this game.
From one Southeastern Conference legend to another. Rap Game with RP3. I'm your host, Raymond Parsa III, here on 103.7 The Game. Broadcasting live from the 237 Roof Studios, presented by Lafayette Roofing. That was, of course, the old ball coach. A national treasure.
I mean, if Steve Spurrier couldn't save the Alliance, I mean, what is Bob Stoops going to do for the XFL? I mean, that's...
If I'm the XFL, I'm calling up Steve Spurrier. They need coaches. They still don't have all their coaches lined up. They got Bob Stoops. Why not poach Steve Spurrier away from the Alliance?
I'm going to go all
is,
black.
Is there an XFL team in Florida somewhere?
I mean, I don't know if it's announced yet or not, but I'm going to go all black helicopters here and say that the Alliance was also in the back of the books, under the table, was funded and run and everything also by Vince McMahon. Vince McMahon runs the XFL. He was also in charge of the Alliance, despite what reports and people may think. He wanted to do this as a dry run before, because, you know, he said 2 years, 2020, the XFL is coming. And then like 2 weeks later, we had the announcement the Alliance is coming. I think Vince McMahon is the Alliance, and he wanted to run through and see where all the differences are, where we're going to screw up, what things. And Vince McMahon, being the genius businessman that he is, he didn't need the full season. He figured it out in like 8 games, and it was fine. He's done. So he shut it down. XFL coming to a television screen near you.
I have questions about the Alliance. I'm a fan of trying to have spring football be a thing. I think there's a place for it. I think the market reflects that. I think the ratings were good enough for the Alliance. Was the football the best football you had seen, Cody Schutz? No.
No, but it was just as good or better than Tuesday night action.
Okay, it was comparable. And you did have some names like Trent Richardson, who led the league in rushing touchdowns. You got the Memphis Express, who had all the LSU players in the Alliance played for the Memphis Express.
And Johnny Manziel.
You added Johnny Manziel. You had the Met Show. Okay, you had the old ball coach with the Orlando Apollos, who do end the inaugural and only season of the Alliance with the best record. They should crown him champions. I want there to be a ceremony, and I want to see the old
Throw
ball
a parade.
Coach. I want to see the old ball coach hoist a piece of hardware. Okay? You have some personalities. It's the first year. So when you go into these endeavors, when you're starting up a spring football league, which I do believe he can succeed in here in our country, the USFL succeeded before a businessman decided to become an investor and try to go head-to-head with the NFL. And sure enough, here we are, and we have another guy who jumps in, is not part of the initial investment in the league, jumps in as an investor, and then wants to make demands to the NFL saying that we need your players. And now this league is folding too. Memo to everyone trying to start up a spring football league. If powerful businessmen who are braggadocious try to insert themselves into your league, run away, because they will be the death nail of your league.
You can't,
always.
In my opinion, you can't ask for help. If you are, you know,
what are you doing?
Is the Alliance a direct competitor competition for the NFL? No.
Oh, hell no.
But despite that, you can't ask for help from somebody that, even as small of a push as it may be, you technically, you know, are in the same business. They are both in the business of football. The Alliance asking, why would the NFL say, yeah, Alliance, here you go. Let me, possibly to the detriment of my league, let me help your league be better so maybe one day your league can be more popular than mine? Like, no, the NFL's not going to do that. It's the same. I'm going to step in it here. Hold on, because I want to step in it.
Okay.
It's the same concept as why diehard Cajuns fans who hate LSU despise LSU for never playing UL. But why would LSU bring UL in for a football game where UL is going to get a $1 million check to make UL's program better so that one day UL could maybe be better than LSU?
Correct.
LSU's not going to do that. The NFL's not going to do that.
Why would you want to give up your perch on top of the mountain?
That's my point. Thank you.
But
that's
here's the thing. You had smart football people, Charlie Ebersole, Bill Polian, founded this, and then they brought in Tom Dundon, who actually turned out to be the Grim Reaper for the league. How do you not have the money in place? How do you not have the infrastructure in place to at least get through a damn year that you don't have to need $250 million from an investor who ends up wanting to bury your league? There's so many questions here of what could have been done differently, and now these guys don't have jobs. Hopefully, there's enough tape on them, they'll get an invite to a camp and an NFL team will try to sign them. Not to mention all the low-level people that worked in the front office, the 9-to-5ers, that were like, hey, this is a great thing. Come here for a couple years. Oh, 8 weeks later, you're unemployed. All this could have been avoided if people would have been better prepared and not rushed things, which is a good reason why it's a good sign for Vince McMahon that they waited an additional year for the XFL. Can spring football actually be a thing here in this country? I say yes, but you have to run it right.
Undetermined. Oliver Luck, good luck, my friend.
Yes, good luck. We'll be praying to baby Jesus for you. When we come back here on the Rap Game with RP3, the voice of the LSU Tigers, Chris Blair, will join us on 103.7 The Game. Welcome back to the Rap Game with RP3. I'm your host, Raymond Parsh III, here on 103.7 The Game. We're broadcasting live from the 237 Roof Studios, presented by Lafayette Roofing. The LSU Tigers got a win on the diamond last night versus the Grambling State Tigers, their second shutout of the season. They'll be back on the diamond tonight at Alex Box Stadium. You can listen to the game live right here, first pitch at 6 o'clock on 103.7 The Game, your home for the LSU Tigers. Right now, we're going to talk a little baseball and do some wrap-up on the men's basketball season as we head out to the Arco Equipment Hotline and welcome on the voice of the LSU Tigers, the one and only Chris Blair. Chris, how are you this morning, brother?
Doing fantastic. Hope you're doing well.
Doing well. I am doing well. So let's go back to the Sweet 16 and kind of recap the men's basketball season. Michigan State just proved to be just too tough. Cassius Winston was just too good. Sparty got out to a quick 8-0 lead there, Chris. LSU tried to battle back, but they just didn't have enough in the tank, so to speak. What were your thoughts about the Sweet 16 and how the game ended for the Tigers versus Sparty?
Well, I think Michigan State, you know, again, came out as the aggressor, and, you know, it's interesting looking back at Tom Izzo's press conference on Thursday. I mean, one of the things he hammered home to the media, which you could tell is something that he had spoken often of with the team, was that LSU's a physical team. LSU's a team that likes to come out, get off to a quick start, build a big lead. And, you know, he talked about having to be able to withstand that. But something tells me he was telling his team, we need to go out and be physical. And they are a physical team. I mean, that's kind of the Big Ten's M.O., you know, so they were able to do so. I mean, they dominated on the glass early. They were physical on defense. They allowed no creases, no dribble penetration. And then, you know, to boot, you know, they averaged about 7 made threes a game. And, you know, they came out and made 7 in the first half. And there was a stretch there in both the first and second half where, they just didn't miss. You know, they shot the ball extremely well. So you put that combination together, and that's an uphill climb, not just for an LSU team, but as we found out, an uphill climb for a number one overall seed Duke Blue Devil team. I remember telling Coach Brady towards the end of the game during a timeout, I said, hey, if they play like this with the physicality and hit some shots, maybe not as many, but, you know, if they hit around 40% or higher, I mean, this is a team to beat not only tonight but the rest of the way. And as it turned out, I still believe they're going to be tough to tangle in the Final Four. It was a little reminiscent of last year's team in the sense that Tremont Waters led the way with 23 points. But, you know, he didn't have a whole lot around him, especially offensively. And even though they did cut it to a four-point lead, went on an early run there to start the second half, again, because of the outside shooting and rebounding prowess, you know, Michigan State went on an 11-0 run. And, you know, you look up and it seemed like mere seconds later it was back to a 15-point lead. And just too much to overcome. But overall, I mean, it was a great season for LSU. I mean, they captured the SEC regular season title. For the 11th time. I mean, they had their best year really since 2006 when it comes to postseason play. So, you know, there's a lot of good there. And obviously, there's a lot of question marks. And as I mentioned on the air, you know, every team that was in the Sweet 16, basically every team that was in the 64, there's going to be a lot of changes. That's just the way college basketball is. I mean, there's a lot of question marks for the Duke Blue Devils, who's going to return, Michigan State. So, again, there's some added mystery to what will happen with LSU moving forward. But, again, you got to just enjoy the season. It was fun to be a part of it. It was fun to have basketball at the forefront again on campus. And, you know, we'll just have to see where it goes from here.
We're talking to Chris Blair, the voice of the LSU Tigers. Chris, I want to kind of focus in on a little bit of that as well because, I mean, it was a tremendous season. You get to put up on the banner, a regular season championship. You also get to put a Sweet 16 appearance, the first since 2006. A lot of great things are being ranked in the top 10. But, you know, I feel like for maybe some of these guys, it's some unfinished business as well. I know Tremont Waters earned honorable mention, AP All-American honors yesterday. But there's some question marks. Is he coming back? Is Naz Reid coming back, the sensational freshman who seemingly got better as the season progressed, the big fella? We know they lose Cavell Bigbee Williams, but they could still have Tremont Waters come back. They could still have Naz Reid come back. We know Skylar Mays isn't going to go anywhere with his academic aspirations. Javonte Smart could come back. There's a lot of good pieces. From someone who covers the program day in and day out and you're so connected to it, what's the likelihood do you think that these guys decide, you know what, yeah, we made it to the Sweet 16, that's great, but we want more. We want to try to make a run to the Final Four. Let's all come back and give it another shot next year.
Well, I think that, you know, there's something to be said for the fact that these guys, because of the things they had gone through this season, you know, prior to even the start of the season, became a close-knit group. And all teams become, you know, a family in that sense of the word. But, you know, this was a little bit different based on, you know, the things that they had to go through and the hurdles they had to overcome. So, I mean, there certainly is a close-knit feeling, more so than maybe the typical team. But I think, you know, again, there's just a question mark as to, you know, who's going to be the head coach. And rightfully so, if you're 18, 19, 20, 21 years old and you're making a decision on the rest of your life, I mean, you've committed, obviously, to a program. But let's face it, I mean, players, certainly in basketball when you talk about the numbers, but it really applies to all sports. You made that decision based on the comfortability you had with either the head coach or the head recruiter on the staff. So there's some loyalty there. I do think there's a feeling from these guys that, you know, there were some things down the stretch that maybe affected them and affected the ability for the team to maybe reach its full potential. Of course, we'll never know. So I think that's, you know, there's decisions that are going to be made outside of their hands that I think will impact what they decide to do. Now, take away all that, the extracurricular and the periphery. I think Naz Reid is the type of guy that, you know, is going to have an opportunity because, as you pointed out, his season improved and he became not just a big guy that had a good handle and liked to shoot three-pointers occasionally. I mean, he became a really solid inside player, and a lot of credit to that goes to the coaching staff. Obviously, they needed him to be that guy. They needed him to be an inside four, and he was really able to adapt his game and improve in that area. And I think you see a lot of people, you know, in the know on the NBA draft felt like that he might be able to go either late first round or early second round. Now, Now you're talking about serious money and serious life-changing opportunities. So I think from his standpoint, I would be a little surprised, regardless of what happens, that he comes back. Tremont Waters, if you remember last year, went to work out with the NBA. It's something that I think that is good for college basketball, especially if we're going to live in this one-and-done society, that you're allowed to go and kind of see where you are with other pro prospects and have an opportunity for, you know, professional teams to take a look at you and give you an evaluation. And, of course, he made the decision not to sign with an agent and come back for his sophomore season. I think there's an opportunity for him to do the very same thing this year and, again, try to see where the feedback is, how much he improved from last year to this year, and then make a very educated decision. So I think there is a chance there. And then, you know, the rest of the guys, I think it's all kind of going to depend on again, the decisions that will be made, you know, from the administration standpoint and the coaching standpoint as to whether or not, A, they go to the professional ranks, or B, they decide that, you know, without the coach that they wanted to play for not being there, maybe they decide to try to get a waiver from the NCAA and go play somewhere else. So, again, every team's got question marks. I think there's certainly a ton for LSU, some of which will not be made until, you know, some other people make decisions.
Chris, let's switch over from basketball to football. The spring game will be on Saturday. You listen to it live right here on 103.7 The Game starting at 1 p.m. I know you've been so focused with your responsibilities with basketball and then obviously also baseball, but I know you stay connected with the football program. What are some things that you're looking forward to seeing on Saturday with the spring game?
Well, you know, Coach Ogeron mentioned to the media yesterday that, you know, obviously they're not going to be opening up the playbook and you know, doing any type of real exotic stuff, especially offensively. But for me, you know, a spring game, I've never – you know, been a part of one that, you know, actually just went out there and threw everything out for everybody to see, not just fans, but obviously opponents and conference rivals and the like. So that doesn't surprise me all that much. For me, what I'm looking for is basically the fluidity and the crispness, you know, especially on offense. I mean, it's going to be interesting defensively to see, you know, some guys who play with high energy and kind of take that leadership role from, you know, the likes of Greedy Williams and Devin White, who are now getting ready to move on to the next level. But offensively, I'm just looking for the crispness. You know, and again, in spring football, you're going to see a lot of young guys who haven't played a lot, some newcomers that haven't played at this level, haven't played in the system, but several weeks, you know, there's going to be some issues there. But for me, the overall thing I'm looking for is how fluid the offense looks, how comfortable Joe Burrow, when he's in, looks, the steps that Miles Brennan has taken. Obviously, he's put some size on him, and the coaches have raved about what he's done in the spring. So be interested to see how he handles things, you know, from that standpoint. But I think it's more about operationally looking at how the Tigers fare on Saturday, because that's kind of one of the things that, you know, I think Coach O has talked about, feeling comfortable with, you know, where the coaching staff has led this team, what they've been working on from a fundamental standpoint, as far as X's and O's as well. So, to me, it's not about, you know, what the numbers look like and the passing percentages and the yardage and the points. It's more about the overall system and how smooth things look and how comfortable everybody looks running whatever plays they decide to go with.
We're talking with Chris Blair, voice of the LSU Tigers. Chris, let's go to the Diamond. Baseball team had themselves a heck of a weekend going into Stark Vegas, taking 2 of 3 from the Bulldogs, especially after how the opening game of that series started off. They end up taking the series and building some momentum. They blank Grambling last night. What do you think about this baseball team right now? Do you think that Mississippi State series is going to kind of help them kind of get on track, back on track, so to speak?
Well, I like the fact that the pitching in the first three weekends of SEC play, for the most part, have been solid. I mean, you're still missing some key arms that are, you know, battling some soreness and trying to get back to full strength. And you've had starters and middle relievers and long relievers be able to go in games one and game two and be able to not just eat up innings and save arms for game three, but pitch effectively and give your team a chance to win. And that's exactly what happened on Thursday. It wasn't Zach Hess's best night. But, boy, what a job Trent Vitmire did. The sophomore comes in, and again, a Mississippi State team that had scored just boatloads of runs, especially the weekend before, kind of felt like they were going to come in. They got off to a, you know, a 6-0 lead. It looked like they were cruising, or 6-2 lead, I should say. Looked like they were cruising. And then Bittmeyer comes in and just shuts it down. And I think what happened, you saw a little bit of the confidence of Mississippi State wane. And then in the eighth inning, when LSU made that, you know, very good comeback, had a chance to tie or even take the lead late in that game, you know, you started to see them gain some momentum. And then that carried over to game two and game three. And frankly, LSU won those two games going away. But to me, the pitching you have to be very pleased with in conference play. They've done an excellent job. Was shorthanded in the bullpen, were starters and the relievers basically using two pitchers, maybe two and a half inning or an inning from Todd Peterson, to be able to play an entire game. So you got to be pleased with that. Offensively, I think there was some, confidence gained by LSU. And obviously you can't talk about last weekend without mentioning CJ Willis, the freshman out of Ruston coming in and, you know, in that spot in the eighth inning. Stone Cold comes in, delivers a double, and scores a run. And since then, he's been inserted into the starting lineup, and he's done a very good job at the plate. So I think if you have to look at where LSU is now, and it should come as no surprise. I mean, it's normally somewhere around mid-April you see things start to really click and the lineup really becomes solid for Coach Pulmonary. Hopefully maybe a little bit earlier this year. But they looked good last night. Again, Clay Moffitt did an excellent job. They needed him to go deep in the game. He gave him five innings. Scoreless baseball, had a career high with five strikeouts, threw strikes, allowed his defense to back him up. They played error-free baseball behind him. And then you got some runs early, and, yeah, there were opportunities throughout the game to really open it up that they missed on. But, you know, it was 8-0 early after three. They added one late, and really the game was never in doubt. So it's going to be a step up in competition tonight, taking nothing away from Grambling. But South Alabama out of Mobile in the Sun Belt, long time, decades long, good baseball program, and they're one of the better teams out of the Sun Belt Conference year in, year out. This is a makeup game, and tonight it's going to be a little different. Mikel Hilliard's going to get the start, but Coach Maneri has made it clear he can go two, maybe three, depending on how well he pitches, and then they're going to have to piece it together from there to try to save some arms for a very important SEC series against Texas A&M at home this weekend. You know, the Aggies leading the SEC West, the Tigers right there behind him, technically a half game behind in a three-way tie for second place. So it'll be interesting to see how the Tigers respond tonight. They're going to need offense against South Alabama. And, you know, we may see four or five pitchers in the game for LSU, and they're all going to have to contribute and throw the ball well.
Chris, brother, I appreciate you coming on, making time for us, talking hoops, football, and baseball. Had you do the Triple Crown today, brother. I appreciate the assistance, though.
No problem. Enjoy it, man. See you next week.
That's Chris Blair, voice of the LSU Tigers, joining us here on the Wrap Game with RP3. We will wrap up the second hour here on 103.7 The Game after this break. Hey, all you out there listening to the show. It's a Wrap Game with RP3. I'm your host, Raymond Parks III, here on 103.7 The Game, broadcasting live from the 237 Roof Studios, presented by Lafayette Roofing. Just a heads up, we are going to have a very special, exclusive concert announcement coming Friday morning at 7:20. I can't tell you anything else but that we will have an exclusive concert announcement coming Friday morning at 7:20.
Shrouded in mystery.
So if you listen to the Wrap Game, you only have like 10 minutes to listen to the Wrap Game the rest of the week. It needs to be starting around about 7:18 on Friday.
10-4 to that.
10-4 to that. Also, hey, if you haven't already done so, and I know we've been preaching this to you, but if you haven't already done so, you need to go to the 103.7 The Game website and go take part in the 2019 Masters Tournament Challenge for your chance to win a $100 gift card from golfballs.com. It's real easy, guys. The only thing you have to do, go to our website, click on the link, and just pick the golfer you think will win the 2019 Masters. It's that easy. That's all you got to do. Just pick a winner. You don't even have to really know anything about golf. Just go find you a name that speaks to you. You go, you know what? That's a handsome-sounding name. If that's what you want to use, that's fine. Do whatever you can. Just pick your winner.
And you'll have the opportunity to win a $100 gift card from our friends at golfballs.com. If the winning golfer is selected by more than one entry, we will put all correct entries in a raffle and then select a winner. So go check it out. Take part in the 2019 Masters Tournament Challenge for 103.7 The Game. Just when we thought, Cody Schuetz, that the Houston Astros had gotten back on track, they took game one of their series with their hated rival, the Tejas Rangers, there at Globe Life Park in Arlington. And then you had to feel pretty good, because then you had Justin Verlander on the mound last night. He was lights out in the season opener down there in Tampa. But the Stros fall short 6-4 against the Rangers. The Houston Astros are now 2-4 overall on the season. And you thought having Verlander out there would have done it, would have taken care of business. But it wasn't. I know it's early, and I don't want to overreact, because baseball is an immensely long season. Immensely long season. But how you losing to the Texas Rangers? The Rangers are hot garbage. 6-4 loss to the Rangers. And, you know, the Rangers were able to rally in the fifth inning. Su Chu laced a ball to the wall in right center to lead off the inning. With that was a triple. And then Odor followed him. That chased off Verlander, and that kind of took care of it right there, right? I mean, they just 6-4 loss. They'll play again tonight. You can listen to it again. The third game of the series between the Astros and the Rangers. You can listen to it live on our sister station, The Rewind, 97.7 FM, 1330 AM Lafayette, and 104.1 in Lake Chuck. But they had Verlander on the bump and came up short. So you had your best ace out there, couldn't get it done. It's still very early in the season. Baseball's a very long season. But you'd like to see the Astros play a little bit better. They're not the only team that's struggling. The Yankees, they lost that series to the Orioles. The Cubs are having problems with defense. So a lot of your best teams in Major League Baseball, your marquee teams, are struggling to start off the season. Have to see if the Astros can turn things around today against the Rangers in Game 3 of that series. That's going to do it for the second hour of the Wrap Game with RP3. When we come back, I was able to sit down with UL head softball coach Jerry Glasgow yesterday, taped that interview. We're going to play that next, talking about the season they're having, tremendous start, Summer Ellison, and more when we start the third hour of the Wrap Game with RP3 right here on 103.7 The Game.
Live and local from the 237 Roof Studios in Upper Lafayette, we are Acadiana Sports Station, 103.7 The Game, KLWB, Karen Crow, Lafayette. It's time to step your game up.
Boy, you wouldn't know how to write your name if it wasn't set for lunch locker.
It's Rap Game with RP3. Raymond Parks III.
One of God's own prototypes. High-powered mutant of some kind never even considered for mass production. Too weird to live, too rare to die.
Want to interact? Call in at 337-706-0111.
We have it. Yeah, we have it.
RP3 is taking the mic and bringing you to the center of the sports world on Rap Game with RP3 on 103.7 The Game and 1037thegame.com.
You just got to keep living, man. L-I-V-I-N.
I'll tell you what I'm blathering about. I've got information, man.
Welcome back to the Rap Game with RP3. I'm your host, Raymond Parsha III, on this hump day edition of the show. And right now, we're going to head out to the ARCO Equipment Hotline and welcome on our next guest. He's in his second year as the head coach of the UL Raging Cajun softball program. They are ranked nationally in the top 10, and they're on quite a hot streak. They look to keep things going tonight in Lake Charles when they take on the Menice State Cowboys. It's our privilege to welcome back onto the show head coach Jerry Glasgow. Coach, how are you this morning?
Doing great. How are you?
We're doing terrific. We're doing terrific, Coach. Appreciate you taking some time out for us. Let's get right to it. I know you mentioned a little bit at the presser on Monday. you know, that you guys aren't looking at this game as a revenge game. You guys get too much on your plate. What can you, though, learn from the first matchup with McNeese when they surprised you in extra innings? What didn't you do right in that game that you hope that you girls can do right tonight?
Well, we struggled to get on time last time, and I hope tonight we can really, you know, just pick out better pitches. And we're going to have to get on time with a slower velocity. And they did a good job of changing speeds on us. They come in with a slow thrower. You know, I wouldn't be surprised not to see them do it in reverse, where they throw somebody hard first and then go slow later. But it doesn't matter. We just have to adjust to the speed of the pitcher and get good pitches and then drive the ball better than we did last time.
Coach, let's talk a little bit. Even though you had the midweek setback against McNeese, but you guys have been phenomenal for the weekend series. You guys are undefeated in Sun Belt play. You keep winning series left and right. Talk a little bit about how your team rises to the occasion in conference play.
Yeah, you know, it's a really talented team, and they've been pretty consistent throughout the year. We've had a couple of, you know, aberration games, I'd like to think, that where we didn't play our best ball, and that's kind of how the game of baseball and softball is, or how it turns out. But the challenge for us is to be consistent and play at our highest level or close to our highest level. And what we found is if we can play at 85-90% of our best, that's normally going to be good enough to win. And we just want to be consistent down the stretch. We've got 20 games left, and I'd like to see us, you know, play our very best in at least 19 or 18 of those games, and then hopefully, you know, we can find a way to win all of them.
We're talking with head softball coach of the UL Raging Cajuns, the one and only Jerry Glasgow, here on the Wrap Game with RP3. Coach, let's talk a little bit about last year. You guys struggled with the power bats. You only had, I think, 23 or 24, something like that, home runs on the season. This year, as we enter April, you guys already have 47. What's been the difference? Has it been the players, or has it been the approach that you and your staff have done to developing the power hitting in this lineup?
I think it's a combination of more talent. You know, we've really added to our roster, and I think we've increased the talent level of our dugout. And then having the fall to really train and get on the same page where, you know, our players understand us and we understand the players. And I think last year we just didn't have a good approach at the plate. And this year we clearly understand our approach. I told them the first day of practice, you know, we go by OPS, and, you know, we're going to play the kids with the highest OPS. And last year we had one kid with over 900 OPS, and this year our whole team averages around 1,050. So it's a big improvement, and it just comes from more talent and a lot more hard work and better communication.
Coach, let's talk a little bit about the development of Summer Ellison, a former Turlings Catholic star. A lot of the listeners in the area are well aware of what she can do, not only for you guys, but what she did back in high school at Turlings Catholic. She played sparingly her first time here last year. She became you guys' ace of the staff, and she had a heck of a year. This year, she's even better and more dominant for you. How has you and your staff been able to develop her and have her reach that next level, so to speak?
Well, you know, we started out with her last year. She had a really good rise ball, and we tried to develop her drop ball, and it just kept getting better throughout the year. And then in the fall, we started working on off speed, and so now we can, you know, go up, we can go down, we can pull the ball back and throw the off speed more. And then this spring, Coach Roberts has added a curveball. So she's got a really interesting mix of pitches, and then her velocity has been really good here the last month. It seems like as the seasons went on, she just keeps throwing harder and harder. And so she's got a good combination of pitches, and she has a lot better control this year. She gets ahead in the count more. She doesn't get behind much. And, you know, her strikeout-to-walk ratio is like 8-1. So she's really improved in a lot of ways over the last 18 months.
We mentioned how you guys have improved at the plate power-wise, but overall this team is just hitting the ball far better than it was last year. And I know your background is a little bit of a hitting coach, and your stops there at A&M and at Georgia beforehand. What were some of the things that you were able to teach these girls this past offseason heading into this season that you weren't able to do your first season because it was such kind of a rushed atmosphere, you taking over the program?
Yeah. You know, last year we really didn't do any mechanic work. We just come in and tried to maintain the swings that they had, and we challenged them with machines, and we did a lot of you know, we tried to build a databank of pitches where they saw rise balls, they saw drop balls, they saw curve balls and screw balls, and we did a lot of visual training and just maintenance training. This year, when season started to fall, we tried to get on the same page where they understood what I was wanting from them mechanically, the terminology that I use. And then we you know, basically what we do, we use the visual of major league swings, and we try to emulate major league swings. And then you try to teach it in a way that's simple for them to understand. And just having that fall was really, really helpful. And we got the girls, they're swinging more in their legs. Now you see the back knee getting lower to the ground. They're, you know, trying to get away from swinging with their shoulders, swing with their legs and the hands versus the arms and the shoulders. So they bought in. They're doing really, really good. Our average is up. Our slugging percentage is up. Our on-base percentage is up. Our walks to strikeouts is up. So all the key indicators are greatly, greatly improved because kids have worked hard and bought in.
Coach, you guys are in a terrific position. You're ranked in the top 10 nationally in the polls. You guys are having a tremendous season, but knowing you like I do, you're always looking at improvement and how things that you guys can do better and be more efficient. What are some of those things now that we're the season, you're in April, what are some of the things that you and your staff are still working on with your ball club to get them to get even better at?
Well, mainly consistency. We want to be consistent. We hit a stretch there where we were really hitting the ball well and scoring a lot of runs. And then all of a sudden you saw last weekend where we dropped down, and fortunately we were able to win, but we won 2-0, 3-1, and 6-3. And that's a lot different than the weekend before where it was 11, and 14 runs. So I'd like to see us get that consistency. I thought at Troy we won 9-1, 8-0, 8-0. That was a real consistent three game outing. I'd like to see us, you know, really try to find that consistency over the next 20 games, try to have, like, you know, 15 of those games where we score between 6 and 9 runs and try to get away from the games where you just can't explain our offense. And we did that a lot last year. We've done it very few times this year, but going into postseason, I'd like to see us even more consistent and really on an even keel.
You know, we mentioned earlier the type of season that Summers had for you. She's been dominant, leads the nation in wins, is already over 20 wins on the season. What is the game plan moving forward? Are you going to keep just using her every day, or are you going to have Kendra out there and Carrie out there as well and get them some innings and get them some work?
You know, we're kicking that around. I mean, she's got a chance to lead the nation in wins, and I think that's a huge honor, and I want to give her a chance to do that. I want to give her a chance to lead Division I softball and wins. I think that's something she'll remember all of her life, and it'd be great for our program. And so I want to do that if we can. But the key to this whole thing is to keep her healthy for the postseason by limiting the number of pitches. So we may go more for wins and less for strikeouts and try to limit how many pitches she throws. And then we have to get Carrie more and more innings, and we need to get Kendra involved again. We've had her out for a few games, and she had a great bullpen today, really throwing the ball hard now. And I think we need to get her out there on a regular basis, maybe even if it's just for one inning at the end of a game to close it. But we definitely want Summer to have a shot to lead the nation in wins if we can keep her healthy. And if everything right now she feels good, if we start getting a nagging soreness, and, you know, right now there's no elbow, there's no shoulder soreness, if that could change everything. But as long as she's feeling really good and getting plenty of rest between her game day starts, then we'll keep putting her out there.
Philosophy is a little bit different depending on coach to coach. With the status of midweek games, a lot of coaches will tell you that, you know, it's an opportunity to play younger players, kind of spread the ball around, get a lot of bullpen work or get some backups, some playing time. For you, Coach, what's your philosophy with the midweek games? Do you treat them as just as important as your weekend series? There's just no let up for you and your staff with these girls?
Yeah, no, I don't. I think we have to win every single game right now, and we're not in a position that we can just experiment and play around. And I don't think kids – I get to see them every day in practice, and I want to see them compete in the practice, and I want to see them compete, you know, to earn game time. And for us, the fall is critical. You earn your playing time in the fall, and then once we get to season, then we're trying to win every single game. That's just how I think Division I ball should be.
Coach, we'll wrap it up with this. Obviously, you got McNeese State tonight, but this weekend you welcome to Lansom Park, UTA. The record may not suggest that they're a powerhouse team, but they are sneaky good, and they've gone toe-to-toe with you guys in the past, especially last year. What are some of the challenges that UTA presents your ball club?
Well, they've got a really good pitcher in Randy Carroll Phillips. They've got an outstanding shortstop. They've got a great catcher in Wright. They've got three kids, I think, over 400. Four or five, maybe even six, over 300. Their offense is good. If their pitching and offense both goes, then they can be a very formidable opponent for anybody. And they just got a win over Arkansas, who's a top 20 team. They took Texas A&M 1-0, and they jumped up last year. They beat us once, and they beat Oklahoma State last year with Randy Carroll Phillips in the mound. So she's got several top 25 wins already in her freshman sophomore year, and we have to take them very seriously.
Coach, appreciate you making some time for us. Best of luck tonight and the rest of the way.
Thank you, and thank you for your support of our program.
That's UL head softball coach Jerry Glasgow right here on the Wrap Game with RP3. We need to take a break, but we'll be back right after this on 103.7 The Game. Hey, friends. Louisiana Governor John Bel Edwards has proclaimed the month of April as Safe Digging Month here in Louisiana as part of a nationwide safety awareness campaign to draw attention to the importance of safe digging. In Louisiana, there are thousands of miles of utility lines and gas pipelines buried just beneath the surface. So if you or a contractor you hire is digging a hole to put in a new fence, a pool, or a garden, you run the risk of hitting an underground line even by digging only a few inches. That's why it's so important for everyone to dial 811 and call Louisiana One Call 2 days before they dig. You just tell the operator your address and someone will come out and mark the location of the buried lines so you or your contractor can avoid them. It's simple, it's free, and it's the law. Anyone that's digging or demolishers are required to notify Louisiana One Call before they begin work. The law applies to individuals as well as contractors, municipalities, and others. Failure to call can subject the person to fines and liability for damages to buried infrastructure. Call 811 and know what's below before you dig. It's been a jam-packed show, ladies and gentlemen. You can give us a call on the ARCO Equipment Hotline at 337-706-0111 if you want to talk about any of the subjects we have touched on today. We started things off with previewing the Final Four. Yesterday it was Texas Tech. Today we broke down a little bit of the Spartans of Michigan State, who will be playing Texas Tech in one of the semifinal games on Saturday. We also talked about Cajuns baseball getting a much-needed midweek win over the Lions of Southeastern Louisiana. Also, Tony Robichaud, congratulations to him once again for picking up career win number 900 as the skipper of the Raging Cajuns. He has nearly 1,200 wins total in his career, which began at McNeese State. But Tony got win number 900 as the skipper of the Raging Cajuns last night.
I'm going to have to look that up, but that's overall, not 900 just here, but his over 1,200 total wins. That either rivals or maybe surpasses Paul Mainieri. It's got to be close.
He's close to 1,200.
I'm going to check on that.
Check on that. Cody Schutz, research extraordinaire. We also talked We also talked LSU baseball dominating Grambling State in a midweek contest. They'll be back at the box tonight taking on South Alabama. That's a makeup game that was rained out or canceled due to weather. You can listen to that game live right here on 103.7 The Game at 6 o'clock. Ben Love will have bumper-to-bumper sports for 2 hours from 4 to 6. He'll lead us right into first pitch. No pregame today, just the game. We also discussed the new NFL draft night hats by New Era. Talked a little bit about them. Threw up the Twitter poll question whether or not they were hot fire or hot garbage.
It is an overwhelming support for hot garbage. not a fan so far of 72% coming through of hot garbage.
It's a mixture of both for me. It's a mixture of both for me. We also talked with a Louisiana legend, LSU star Warren Morris, who had the most famous
and memorable moment in College World Series history, his game winner home run against Miami in the College World Series. We took a trip down memory lane with him. He also talked what he liked about this year's team. We also talked to Chris Blair. He gave us kind of recap and put a bow on the LSU men's basketball season. Also touched on LSU spring football. By the way, the spring game is this Saturday at 1 o'clock. You can listen to it live right here on 103.7 The Game. We also talked about the Astros inexplicably losing to the Tejas Rangers in game two of their series. And we also talked a little WrestleMania because...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Well, Cody Schutz is here.
I mean, I'm pumped. No, I mean, WrestleMania is what it is. I don't want to go off on too hard of a tangent, so to speak. But before I do that, I have found the answers to my questions. Coach Robichaux, 900 wins here at University of Louisiana. Overall, he has 1,163 wins. So he's still a good chunk away from 1,200 total wins. So he's 1,163 wins for Coach Robichaux.
He's only 37 wins away. So you're looking at, if they have a good season next year, he could get that by the end of next year in postseason.
Oh, no. I mean, yeah. But it's still, he's not like five games away, I guess, is what I was saying. Handful or so. Coach Mineri, on the other hand, though, and do you know off the top of your head how many seasons Coach Robe has total?
I want to say it was either seven or eight at McNeese, right?
Right. He was here. He came here in 95.
Yeah.
And then so if it was so...
I think it was like 7 or 8 years, roughly.
So quick math, it's not quite 36. It's not quite the number that you hit yet for his coaching career, which is the coaching career length of Paul Mineri so far. He's been a head coach for 36 years, started at St. Thomas in 84, and then he started at Air Force, Notre Dame, of course, and then LSU. Coach Mineri has 1,415 wins. So solid 200 and some change, or 300 and some change more than Coach Robichaux, but I would like to do the specific math to find out how many more years he's coached.
And he did a very good job at Notre Dame.
Right, right.
And that's a tough place to have a baseball program.
It's freezing all the time. All the time.
Yeah, it's freezing cold up there.
You have to play the first 2 months of your season on the road. Regardless, you have to. No, he said that before. When you're a coach up there, that's why LSU played. I forget who they brought in at the beginning of the season, but like Maryland this year for UL. Maryland came down here because no one's going to Maryland in the middle of February. Like, it's just not happening.
This is not happening, Raymond. So, yeah. So that'll be interesting. I'm getting pumped up. We're still a few weeks away, but the Wally Pontiff Classic, man, LSU UL on the 16th. Oh, that's going to be good down there at the Shrine on Airline.
I've never been to.
This will be my first year.
I've never been to one. It seems like so much fun.
We should go.
I mean, maybe it's the problem is it's always in the middle of the week for me. It makes it tough.
Look, man, you just power through. Drink a couple 5-hour energy drinks.
It's not like we haven't done it before. You ain't wrong.
I've never had one of those, by the way.
Oh, I usually drink two at a time.
I bought one once, and I was like, I'm going to use it. And I was flying. I was doing some air traveling. I was like, I have to get up. I got to go to a rental car and everything. I just always go with, like, getting me, like, a Coke. Like, I'll get my caffeine that way. I don't trust when they say, you know, this is made from like berries or nuts or something.
I hear you.
I'm like, really? Really? Yeah.
I mean, as long as we don't, you know, evolve into taking like those, what are they, the Stacker 3 pills or the Yellow Jacket pills you can buy at the gas station over the counter there.
Truck stop meth? Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. I look at them all the time because I stop in gas stations early in the morning to get gas or whatever the case is on my drive into work. And it's like when the gas station is that empty, You can really like look at the things at the counter, and I challenge you, listener, next time you're at a gas station, just peruse what's on the countertop there, and like half of it seems like it should be illegal. I'm just saying, like, it's not, but it just seems like it should be. That's my opinion.
It's not, but it should be. My man said, yeah, I would agree with that.
I don't know, as someone who gets up early all the time, I can't pretend like I haven't been tempted before. Oh, should I take this fluorescent green pill and chew it up and stick it under my tongue to see if that'll wake me up today? Like, I've been tempted, but I've also been more afraid to, like, puke in the garbage can for the entire time during the show because of, like, terrible reactions.
Don't buy that stuff at the counter. don't get your cologne from the vending machine in the restroom either.
I've only been in one place that does that. I've been in one place that does that. I'm not going to talk about it. We're going to leave it right there. But I've been in one place in my life that does that. And
I've been in far more than just
awkward.
Once.
Awkward. A little awkward there.
I was like, why is this here? What? No? What?
Mine's even better. It wasn't just like you could buy the cologne. There was an actual person. Like there was no, yeah, he turned the sink on for you and everything. And I'll leave it at this. It was a little out of place. It didn't seem like that was the spot. Like when you were in this establishment and you went to the bathroom, you thought at first it was really weird. Why is this guy just hanging out in here? And then you realize, oh no, he's actually doing his job. And then you realize, why does this place hire that guy? Like it's just a...
I've only encountered that once, and I made sure to like overly tip the guy for giving me soap.
Yeah,
I felt so bad. I was like, this guy has to deal with drunk people in here in the restroom. I feel this is all the money I have left. just here you go. God bless you.
I mean, the establishment I'm referring to wasn't just a bar. A little more going on than that.
It was a flea market. It was a flea market, is what you're trying to say.
It was right down the street. Right down the street.
When we come back here on the Rap Game with RP3, we're going to talk to our good friend, Les East of CrescentCitySports.com. He's going to give us Pels and Saints talk as always. So stay tuned for that right here on 103.7 The Game. Welcome back to the Rap Game with RP3. I'm your host, Raymond Parsa III, here on 103.7 The Game, broadcasting live from the 237 Roof Studios, presented by Lafayette Roofing. It's time for our final guest of the day. We always bring him in on Wednesdays now. We're going to head out to the Arco Equipment Hotline. He works for CrescentCitySports.com, covering the New Orleans Saints and the New Orleans Pelicans. It's our good friend, the one and only Les East. Les, how are you this morning, brother?
Doing well, Raymond. How are you?
I'm doing well, man. I didn't think we'd have much news to get to today, but sure enough, the Saints make a move yesterday, so I want to dive right in with you. The Saints announced that they were bringing back cornerback P.J. Williams on a one-year deal. That was according initially by Ian Rappaport. The one-year deal is worth about $5 million, but it's reported that it's going to be incentive-laden. What did you think about them bringing back P.J. Williams? There was thoughts that they may not, especially considering that the former Florida State Seminole was arrested for a DWI the Wednesday after the Saints lost in the NFC Championship game. But they bring him back. Are they going to keep him at corner? Is there going to be position change? Your thoughts on P.J. Williams coming back?
Well, I think it's a good move. I don't think it was one that they absolutely had to make. But if you look at the list of free agents going into the signing period after Mark Ingram, there weren't really a lot of impact players on the roster, but there were a lot of players like P.J. Williams who had sort of become the useful role players. And I think last year, after the acquisition of Eli Apple, a couple of games into the season, P.J. Williams started to find himself when he wasn't being asked to be one of the top two corners, and he sort of settled in playing in the nickel primarily, and I think played well. I think probably the last 12 games or so of last season was the best he's played for the Saints, and so I think he showed some potential there, and they could have withstood that loss if he had elsewhere. But I think he's a useful piece, and it was good that they were able to come to terms with him. I think probably an incentive-laden contract makes sense from the Saints' standpoint. So it was not something they had to do, but I think it's good that they were able to get it done because he's a guy who does have some value as a role player, and teams play so little base defense nowadays that even playing in the nickel, he's, I would guess, a quasi-starter.
Les, that being said, you know, we got Marshawn Lattimore as the number one. Eli Apple took over the number two spot. Patrick Robinson was supposed to be the number two corner, and he got injured and missed all of last season, and that allowed PJ to kind of take over that nickel role, so to speak. So where does that now? I mean, you're going to have Lattimore and Apple as your 1-2. Is Robinson going to be slated as the nickel? What do they do with PJ? Is there a possibility that he switches over to safety? How do you see that kind of shaking out?
Yeah, I think that's something that will be determined during the offseason and probably training camp. I think there's some uncertainty about Patrick Robinson. He was the nickel back. If he's healthy, I think he will probably continue to be the primary nickel back, which would leave open the possibility that they would look at PJ at safety, though he would also probably play some at the nickel. But, you know, Robinson had a bad leg injury. I think they're expecting him to come back, but I'm not sure it's guaranteed that he's going to be as good a player as they expected when they first signed him last year. So I think there's some uncertainty about exactly whether Patrick Robinson's going to be the player they were hoping to get when they signed him. And so PJ gives him some insurance there. If Robinson is fully recovered and is able to resume his role as the primary nickel back, then it gives him some latitude to look at PJ maybe at safety and move him around. But you need a lot of guys who can cover in the secondary, and usually somebody's going to get hurt back there. So you need a lot of numbers back there, and it'll sort itself out one way or another. But I do think there's the possibility that they'll take a look at him somewhat at safety.
We're talking with Les East of CrescentCitySports.com. Les, let's talk a little something that came out a day ago, that the Saints have scheduled a workout with Louisiana Tech defensive end Jalen Ferguson. He's the NCAA's all-time sack leader. He's a born-and-bred state guy, developed after being redshirted there at Tech into a pass-rushing machine. We've seen what he can do against top-level competition. He got a sack against LSU last year inside Tiger Stadium. This is a guy who some think may be a late first-rounder, but definitely going to be taken in the second round, early second round, though. The Saints got him in for a workout. What are your thoughts about that, and do you think this is an indicator that they may try to trade up in the second round to try to get this guy and give themselves another young pass rusher?
I could see them looking for another young pass rusher with Alex Okafor signing with Kansas City. You know, they're assuming Marcus Davenport's going to be the starter. In Okafor's place, so they can use another one. I don't know that they would trade up to get a pass rusher as valuable as those guys are. I just don't know that they needed enough to trade up to get him. If he's there with the second pick, with the second round pick, they could possibly take him there. They're in a good position in that. After signing Jared Cook and addressing tight end, they don't really have a crying need where they definitely have to fill a position, especially with their highest pick. So they can look at adding depth and maybe picking somebody even at a position of strength. So I could see them maybe going for another pass rusher, and if they think he's the right guy, maybe picking him. But I'm not sure that they would be trading up at this point. They have so few picks in this draft. I'm not sure that they would want to dilute that any further. They could move a pick or two from next year's draft because they're going to be all in on this season. So I wouldn't rule it out, but I think that's probably more likely a case of them, if they like him, hoping he's there with their second-round pick.
Les, if you had a kind of, with the Saints addressing all their needs, okay, through free agency, they added depth at every position. So they don't have to draft for a need. So they have a luxury, which I know Mickey Loomis and in particularly Jeff Ireland like to do. They like to draft the best available player, right? That's kind of their mantra. That's what they like to do. Do you think with that mindset and filling all the needs that they did in free agency, do you think they hold on to that 2020 pick and not trade up and just see who falls to them there in the second round?
I think that's probably their preference. They've been pretty aggressive in going to get players that they really like, most notably and most recently Marcus Davenport, but they've done it on other occasions as well. And so I don't think they're adverse to doing that. And if the right guy is there, I could see them doing that, but I think probably their preference at this point would be to not have to do that and to get a player who can contribute with that second-round pick. You know, I think they are all in on this year. That window is closing with Drew Brees. But at the same time, you know, Brees is going to be gone in a year or two or whatever it winds up being. And they want to still be competing for Super Bowls even after he's gone. And so I don't think they want to mortgage the future any more than they have to. They're in a pretty good spot right now for next year. So I think they're going to be judicious in evaluating whether or not they should give up future picks to move up this year. It would probably have to be a really special player.
We're talking to Les East of CrescentCitySports.com. Les, I want to switch over to the other franchise there in New Orleans, the Pelicans. Only four games left remaining in this kind of season that will be known for many things, including the firing of Dell Demps and Anthony Davis's trade request and the team kind of just blowing up. That said, four games left, the Pels are tied with the Wizards for the eighth worst record in the league, and this is how this is going to help affect their lottery system. What do you think needs to occur starting tonight against Charlotte when the Hornets come to town at 7 o'clock there at the Smoothie King Center? Do you think the mindset should be for this team just to go ahead and lose the final four games to help their lottery stakes?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I haven't done a math on it, but I don't think it means a whole lot of ping-pong balls. But I just think it's unhealthy to ever take that attitude. I realize they're being cautious with a lot of injured players. Drew Holiday had surgery. Etuan Moore is not going to play. I'm pretty sure Anthony Davis is not going to play. I'm sure they'll be cautious with Frank Jackson with a concussion. So they're holding out a lot of players because of injuries and out of an abundance of caution. So that alone limits the possibilities for winning the game. But I still think you're always better off sending your players out there with the mindset that they're going to do the best they can individually and collectively to try and win the game. It's just, I think, counterproductive from a psychological standpoint not to take that approach. And whether they have a few more ping-pong balls or a few fewer ping-pong balls, I don't really think matters. It's a matter of luck, and either you get lucky or you don't. So I think they're going to go out there and prepare to win, but they have such a limited roster right now that their chances of adding to that win total in these last four games is fairly limited. Charlotte is still mathematically alive for a playoff berth, even though they're in the middle of a disastrous road trip. I would think there's a pretty good chance that they can lose this game tonight, regardless of how they approach it.
And here's the thing, too, Les, to kind of piggyback off of that, the remaining opponents for the Pels are all teams that are going to be in the mix too for in the lottery. The Hornets tonight, then they have to play at the Suns, who are one of the worst teams, and then the Kings, who have now played themselves out of the playoffs. Obviously they wrap up with the Warriors, but they're going to be facing teams that may be trying to position themselves too. So we're going to see some ugly basketball tonight, Les, and moving forward in these final four games.
Probably some, although those two road games, you know, Phoenix and Sacramento have both been playing pretty well down the stretch. They both have a lot of young players who, like the Pelicans, have been trying to establish themselves and played well. And the Kings were just eliminated from the playoffs within the last week. And the Suns have played very well. They beat Milwaukee a couple of weeks ago. I think they beat Golden State in Oakland. And they had that remarkable comeback against the Pelicans when they were, I think the Pelicans were up 5 with the ball with just a few seconds left. They won it in regulation. So, you know, I think you're going to run into a couple of teams on the road that definitely are not thinking about the lottery. They're thinking about finishing strong. And I think the Pelicans are trying to do the same thing, but they're just so limited now with the personnel that they have that every game's going to be a struggle for them.
Les, we'll wrap it up with this, brother. You know, they traded, they drafted Buddy Hield, and then they traded him away less than just a few months into his rookie season. They traded him to Sacramento to get Boogie Cousins. And obviously, things didn't work out with Boogie. He left. They didn't have anything to show for it. And Buddy Hield has turned himself into a hell of a basketball player in the NBA. As more time goes by, is that something that the Pels are going to look back on and go, boy, that was one that we kind of dropped the ball at?
Well, we probably. I mean, he was a good pick at the time, and he's developed extremely well. I mean, he's a really good young player who might be a star someday. But, you know, there's always going to be two ways of looking at that. You look at what they have to show for Buddy Hield and what Buddy Hield is doing, and you're going to say, boy, that was just terrible. And there's some truth to that, but you also have to look at it in the context of how things played out. And at the time they made the trade for DeMarcus Cousins, Buddy Hield looked like a guy with some potential, but he hadn't yet established himself. It was so early in his career, he hadn't had much of an opportunity. But at the same time, DeMarcus Cousins gave them a chance to get over the hump and get into the playoffs. And a year after the trade, it looked like it was a good trade until the injury happened. And then even after the injury, when they brought in Nicholas Mirotić, it looked like they were in good shape. So, yeah, when you look at what they have now and what Buddy Hield is now, it looks like a terrible move. But when you go back to where things were when they made the move to get DeMarcus Cousins, I don't think you can be nearly as critical of what their thinking was at the time the move was made. That's always going to be a thing that's it just depends on which perspective you choose when you look back on that. And they're always going to wish they still had Buddy Hield, but I don't think you can be too critical of what they were trying to accomplish at the time they made the trade.
Les, appreciate the insight as always, my friend. Enjoy the rest of the week, and we'll talk to you next week.
Okay, thanks, Raymond.
Les East, CrescentCitySports.com, covers the Saints and Pels, giving us some insight, as always. When we come back here on the Wrap Game with RP3, we will wrap up this hump day edition of the show right here on 103.7 The Game. Just a reminder, folks, tonight you can listen to LSU baseball versus the South Alabama Jaguars live at Alex Box Stadium right here on 103.7 The Game. The good brother Ben Love will be hosting Bumper to Bumper Sports from 4 to 6. He's going to lead you right into the game. No pregame show tonight. It'll be Bumper to Bumper Sports and then live LSU baseball from Alex Box Stadium as the Tigers take on the Jaguars. First pitch, 6 o'clock. If you want to listen to your Astros, we got you covered there as well. You can find the Astros on the Rewind, our sister station, 97.7 FM, 1330 AM Lafayette, and 104.1 over in Lake Chuck, as they'll be taking on the Texas Rangers tonight at 7 o'clock. It was a terrific show. Cody Schutz, thanks for all the hard work today.
You're welcome.
We won't go into great details on what you had to do to save your boy's butt, but I appreciate it nonetheless.
Oh, it really was nothing, though. You're blowing up a nothing situation. But regardless, since we have a couple minutes here and SmackDown was last night, it is WrestleMania week.
Yes.
A big takeaway from SmackDown.
The floor is yours.
A big takeaway from SmackDown, and this will be relevant to wrestling fans or non-wrestling fans. And when I say relevant, I mean you'll at least know what I'm talking about. as opposed to me speaking a different language to someone who doesn't know wrestling. Everyone knows John Cena. Doesn't matter where you are, where you're from, what you do, if you like wrestling, hate wrestling, whatever, you know.
He's that muscle guy from Trainwreck, right?
Yeah, that would be him. I look like I ate Mark Wahlberg. but no, John Cena, we are officially done with Raw and SmackDowns till WrestleMania. We have had the go-home shows. WrestleMania is Sunday. We won't see any primetime TV WWE stuff until the show of shows now.
Correct. No house show either, right? Those aren't televised, but I doubt they have one, right?
I don't know if they do or not. Okay. If they do, it'll be in the New York area.
Okay.
But my big takeaway was we have not seen hide nor hair of one John Cena or The Undertaker leading into WrestleMania. Neither one of them have made an appearance. I don't know what the dealio is. The Undertaker not making an appearance, no way. He's going to be there. John Cena not making an appearance, no way. He's going to be there. So are there two appearances, are they linked in some way? Maybe. They did wrestle at each other at WrestleMania last year. What I think is more likely is John Cena is going to come out and interrupt Elias, who is going to do like a special concert. He's like basically the new Honky Tonk Man. He comes out and plays his guitar, does his thing.
He's a terrible watered down version of the Honky Tonk Man, but yes.
He was
at the show here at the Cajun Dome.
Yeah, I think John Cena is going to come out and maybe interrupt him, and that's where he gets a shine. Maybe Honky Tonk Man, since he's going to the Hall of Fame, will come out and I don't know. My big takeaway is, where is The Undertaker? Where is John Cena? Yes.
Can I raise my hand?
Yeah.
Undertaker, how great would it be that The Undertaker comes out and interrupts Brock Lesnar's match?
Because he broke the streak.
He broke the streak, right. And he gets to tombstone Lesnar and gets his revenge and cost him the title.
It would be a hell of a way to end that main event at WrestleMania. Mm,
so. See?
There's a lot of stuff.
See, we're going.
WrestleMania is going
to
be fun.
Hey, make sure to tune in tomorrow. We got a jam-packed show for you. We'll have John Marques on talking the Final Four. We'll have our good friend Brady Amon back. Favorite WrestleMania memories. We'll have James Yasko talking Strohs. And Andrew Lopez from NOLA.com and the Times Speaking Union breaking down New Orleans Pelicans. That's going to do it for today. Rap Game with RP3 here on 103.7 The Game.